Take a network break. Stock up on virtual donuts for your doomsday bunker and join us for our weekly review of tech news. We've got stories on Brocade, SAP, HPE, Dell EMC, and more. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. Before we dive into the news, I want to thank our sponsors. Network Break is being brought to you by INE. INE has an incredible library of over 8,500 network training videos designed for the network engineer. Offerings include Cisco CCENT and CCIE, plus Wireshark, Juniper, and more. And you can get 15% off any product or an all-access pass by going to ine.com/packet and using the code PACKET. And thanks to our sponsor, ExtraHop. ExtraHop is a leader in real-time IT analytics and a pioneer of wired data, the ultimate lens into digital transactions. The ExtraHop platform provides insight across the IT environment, from the data center to the edge devices to the cloud, helping IT decision leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. If you tweet at ExtraHop and mention the Packet Pushers, you can get a free t-shirt. Jumping into the news, story one, Aris buys Brocade's networking biz, or at least parts of it. Yes.
Finally, some movement.
Movement at last.
Movement at last, yes.
Yeah, so the deal is that Aris, which makes set-top boxes and a lot of equipment for service providers, they're buying Brocade's networking business for $800 million in cash, plus around $77 million for unvested stock awards. The deal was announced very recently. The sale includes the Ruckus Wireless division from Brocade and the ICX campus switch business. That's just campus switches. It's not data center switches. And it also doesn't look like it includes Brocade's routing portfolio. So there's still some pieces that Broadcom's going to have to do something with, but it looks like this deal is going forward with Aris.
You've got to think that they must have tried to sell the whole thing. They didn't get any takers, so they're taking it. They've got this piece, and they're going to take that cash and get it in on. The company that's buying it, Aris, you don't know about them. They're actually quite a very large company. They do multi-billion dollar business selling cable bits and pieces, I think.
Yeah, they do a lot of DOCSIS stuff, and yeah, they sell to cable providers, service providers.
That's right. And they've been sort of flagging. So the general sense is that Aris is trying to transition from being a service provider, edge, you know, selling cable boxes and set-top boxes and edge routers, and move into the enterprise market. And this acquisition gives them the ability to buy Ruckus, which has a fairly substantial percentage in the service provider space. So Ruckus was very popular with the service providers. And this lets them say, well, we get Ruckus. We can sell some of that through our existing channel to the carriers and find some of their products and do some carrier wireless stuff. But what we've now got is a foot where we can start to go back to the enterprise and maybe grow our markets in there. So George Notter from Jefferies published a report, and he was talking about whether Aris can do this. And he was expressing some concerns in that the Aris executive team has no history around the enterprise. So what is it that's suddenly giving them the ability to think that they can make this work? So there are some questions there.
Sure, although I guess the strategy is that by having the campus switch line and the wireless portfolio, they can come to enterprises and say, we've got your 1-2 wired wireless combination, a nice integrated package, so here it is, and here's our footprint.
Yeah, so again, George Notter from Jefferies says he believes that it's not a not-so-great Ruckus transaction. He thinks they're paying very highly for it, and he's lukewarm on the deal. But then I was looking in my RSS feed, and Dell'Oro is like, they're not just excited, they're ecstatic.
Really? So,
yeah. Like, it's not often you actually see Dell'Oro come out on the scope on these sorts of things and actually even publish anything on this topic. But they actually have, and they actually wrote this very glowing review of the whole deal. And I was like, okay, well, there's two ends of the...
Right. Take your pick.
Yes, it's not a lay-down misère. I'd say opinions are varied. So I can see both sides of the coin. You know, Aris has been struggling for growth. It's been at the beck and call of the service providers. If you're an Aris customer, you've got to think to yourself, you know, are they going to be around for the long term if they're only a one-product wonder? So this gives them a chance to break into the enterprise. But as we know, wireless in the enterprise is not an easy thing. The cost of sale is very high. You've got Cisco and other companies out there running 30-40% of selling price as cost of sale. Like, you know, the cost of sales and marketing is 30% of the product. And normally when you sell to the service provider, it's not like that. It's a completely different sales model and profit margin model. So going to be difficult for Aris to make this fly, but not a bad outcome for Ruckus customers.
And Aris, you mentioned maybe overpaying for Ruckus. You should note that Brocade paid $1.5 billion for Ruckus, and Aris is getting it for $800 million, which is basically half. So I think they did pretty well.
Yeah, well, Brocade needed it to grow the business to complete their portfolio, so they were willing to pay for it. And at that time, when they bought it, the wireless market was red hot. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of since started to cool down. And you sort of starting to see people get rational about wireless and realizing that white box is taking its toll in the Wi-Fi industry as much as any other, and that, you know, the new wireless standards, customers aren't racing out to refresh their wireless. You know, 802.11g, there's all the different standards coming up. Ethan did a great podcast just recently about the different Wi-Fi standards and 5G and stuff like that. So check that out when in the priority queue feed if you want to understand more. So I think customers are going to be slow to upgrade, and that's why some of the sales, some of the heat's gone out of the Wi-Fi market overall.
Well, sticking with Brocade for our story too, they announced their earning results, and the company said their first quarter 2017 financials had revenues of $581 million, which is up 1% year over year, but down 12% compared to the previous quarter, and they lost 1 cent per share. They're, of course, attributing this decline in earnings because of the uncertainty kicked up by the Broadcom acquisition. They also did not provide guidance for quarter two because they're going to be picked up by Broadcom.
You can't help but wonder how many deals have suddenly been put on hold.
Absolutely. That's got to be hard for them, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, if you were buying them, you'd be sitting there going, well, where are they going to go? And this uncertainty about who's going to buy the Brocade, because we know Broadcom just wants the Fibre Channel business, has to be a serious consideration for customers as to whether they keep investing. And it's hard to put a positive spin on that, especially considering that the rumors swirling around that, you know, nobody was going to pick up the whole business. And it's not clear who would actually buy Brocade's data center assets, which also leaves their routing assets too. So service providers, a lot of the internet exchange points run their 100 gig units. They've made a big push into selling that sort of stuff. So it is a bit of a worry. The flip side is they didn't shrink, right? So year on year, they actually managed to hold up. So while they were down quarter on quarter, they're actually roughly evens with year over year. Compare that with Cisco, and as we'll talk about later on, HPE, which are down 5 to 15%, you know, across the board.
Right.
So it's not as bad as it sounds in the sense that Brocade has actually managed to contain the damage, I suspect, and they're not actually shrinking like their competitors, but let's see. Not good.
All right, moving on to story three. SAP is getting a license to bill. A UK court case could have some serious ramifications for how customers are charged licensing fees for SAP. SAP took a company called Diageo to court. They are a beverage company.
Diageo. They make booze.
They make booze.
How can you not know that? How can you not know that?
Well, the best known brand of theirs is Guinness, which I have heard of. I didn't know Diageo was
behind
it.
They're one of the biggest suppliers of booze in the world, and they're a massive multinational.
Diageo uses SAP. They have licenses for their database, the SAP databases, and they started using Salesforce applications that were touching these databases. And now SAP is coming back and saying, you didn't get user licenses for the people using Salesforce who are touching SAP databases. So we've got a bill for you. And that bill is £54 million.
Yeah. Now, this is a company that turns over $2.8 billion a year with an operating income or net income, $3 billion. So $54 million is certainly not peanuts, but it's not actually going to kill them. You know, you've got to take these fines in as a percentage of the size of the company. The company itself does a $10 billion turnover in alcohol. That's basically all they do. They have all of the biggest brands in the world are basically owned by Diageo. And there's a couple of other Anheuser-Busch is a U.S. company.
No, now it's a Dutch company.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I keep getting them confused.
Yeah, got bought by InBev, I think, yeah.
The big business, so the big numbers, but also a very big company. The thing here is that, from what I can understand, is that they started to use a Salesforce front end for sales and various different operations and may have been using Salesforce as a way to process orders from their clients. And in the back end, there was a SAP database, and this resulted in a reduction of SAP licensing fees. And then SAP said, well, if you're going to leave us, we're going to kick you in the nuts. So, so we'll take you to court and sue you for the license fees that you've just avoided by shifting that. Because now the users aren't using our database directly, but they're still using our database because they're doing it via Salesforce. Therefore, you should still pay us for all those users.
Right.
It's grim, right? This just doesn't seem in any way morally a correct way to do things.
It seems very extractive. And if I was an SAP customer, I would be very worried about what might be coming in my mail.
I'd be very concerned that SAP might be following the Oracle business model, which does the same thing with its, you know, we've all heard about the Oracle database licensing on VMware. You buy your Oracle licenses for every CPU that you run. The idea was every CPU socket. And when virtualization came along, they started charging you for every CPU socket in your VMware cluster, right? Well, if you've got 1,000 VMware servers in a physical cluster, they wanted to charge you 2,000 CPU licenses, even though you might be running it on just one VM. So that was just the same sort of business model. So you'd have to think, you know, Oracle and SAP must be seeing their license revenue decline, and they're willing to burn their customer relationships and upset them to be able to retain revenue in the short term. Seems a bad way to live.
It does, given that folks could start to migrate to the cloud, although I guess SAP thinks we're deeply entrenched. We have these customers by the proverbial short hairs, and so we can take advantage of that.
Yeah, well, you know, if I was Diageo and I always had 10,000 sales reps around the world or whatever the number might be, but, you know, and I could put them through a Salesforce and integrate with Salesforce and reduce my SAP licensing fees by integrating my Salesforce front end with my SAP back end, I would do that. That makes sense because Salesforce is where my sales reps are anyway. But, you know, SAP must be thinking, where did all our licensing reps? Oh, they just moved them over to something in the middle. Well, you should pay us for all those clients. So just doesn't seem like a way to treat your customers who then might say, the increasingly I'm seeing people say, you know, we have a no Oracle, an anti-Oracle policy, which is we might have Oracle and we'll keep it, but we're not buying anymore. And in fact, we're starting strategies to move away from Oracle and reduce our dependency on them as a supplier. It's not very difficult to get rid of these Oracle accounting apps and sales management and, you know, office automation. And if you're a bank, your Oracle platform and SAP platforms might be running your entire banking infrastructure, might be the whole system. So it's very difficult to get rid of these. But wow, just not a story that you want to see getting out there, I think.
No, not at all. All right, story four, a self-serving survey from HPE. They're touting an IDC survey that says 65% of respondents have moved or considered moving back from public cloud to traditional infrastructure because of capabilities and pricing. This ties into HPE's pay-per-use infrastructure model in which customers will buy on-premise data center equipment but pay in more of a cloud model like usage, which tied into something we talked about recently, which is HPE's acquisition of Cloud Cruiser. So slightly self-serving survey here, but you've actually talked to some folks who are a little disillusioned with public cloud and might be pulling back.
Yeah. In fact, just yesterday I was down in London. I met with some people, some friends, and I was also at an event at the Cloud Camp event in London, talking to people afterwards, and they're saying stories like, we went to move to the public cloud and our purchasing department knocked it back because they weren't going to raise a purchase order every month because it was too expensive for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, or equally other, like the other one was, yes, we're going to go to the public cloud. How much is it going to cost? We need to add it to the budget so we can cash flow it. They go, we don't know. Well, you can't go to the public cloud. So there are weird accounting horror stories as to why you can't go there. But I've already said there are many people who are tourists in the public cloud. And this evidence, you know, when you actually look at the survey questions, I don't know if you looked at them. This is one of those marketing exercises where you actually use surveys to teach customers what you want them to think. Have you ever seen that? You know, so you write the survey in such a way that it's actually, you know, that it's better this way, right?
You're definitely slanting it toward the outcome you want, yes, as much as you can.
Yeah. So if you sort of look at the survey and the questions, you're sort of going like, oh, that's just influencer marketing, trying to get people to think the way you want them to think. But there's also truth to it in that you can go around to enough people and actually say, yeah, we've been in the cloud, but you're going to pull it back out. This links back to the, you know, the story about Snapchat last week. What are they spending? $1 billion over 3 years in public cloud?
Right.
Just enormous sums of money.
Crazy amounts of money.
Just doesn't seem to make sense for static. You know, if your company's only growing by 1% to 10% per year, you actually don't need burst. You need efficiency and cost control. So I'm not always sure that the cloud is where you want to be.
It does seem like there's a little bit of public cloud backlash starting to bubble up as folks are grappling with, you know, aside from the technical challenges of cloud, the cost model now, this recurring revenue stream is suddenly starting to add up, these monthly bills.
And it's also complicated too, because all of a sudden there are hidden costs here, like your data suddenly creeps out of the data center and your security models start to break down and your data privacy officer has problems tracking out where the data is and who's managing it and whether and there are hidden costs here about startups don't have because they just don't care about any of it because they'll be out of business by the time the data protection people actually get onto them. So we'll see.
All right. Well, we've got more news from you, but first we want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, INE. And Greg, tell us what INE is all about.
So Internet Work Expert, or INE as they're known today, has been a longtime trainer of CCIE candidates and specifically, but they've been growing their portfolio into new areas. They've got an incredible library of over 8,500 network training videos designed for the network engineer with the hands-on focus. They're actually be well known to many of you, I'm sure, right? You can watch these videos from any device, including iOS, Android, tablets, PCs, and your favorite video player. You can download most courses a la carte and DRM free so that they're actually playable at a place that suits you. INE, of course, has rack rentals. That is, they have racks of gear that you can then connect to and practice real stuff. This is not just routers. This is the whole portfolio. So if you want IP telephony or UCS, INE invests vast sums of money into these labs, and they can be really great ways to get hands-on experience. So be sure to check out the All Access Pass. That's one subscription that gets you the entire collection of all their courses for $1,000 a year. Now, $999 a year. That's over 330 network-specific courses. 70% of its hands-on demonstrations at the command line or the user interface. It is not death by PowerPoint. It is not just sitting your way through videos. It's actually structured for network engineers and the way that you're working today. All right. So that's actually quite unique. It's INE has the labs, has the expertise, and focuses on this hands-on based training. You can get 15% off any product or an all-access pass like we just talked about. The all-access pass is $999 a year by going to ine.com/packet and using the code packet. That'll get you 15% off. That'll give you every single training product they make. That's all of those for a year, whether you want to do CCNP, CCNA, CCSP, any of the Cisco certs, all of that sort of stuff. It's all covered, $1,000 for the year, and you'll get 15% off if you go to ine.com/packet and use the code packet at the checkout. You'll pay a lot less.
All right. Thanks, INE. Getting back to the news, story 5, Ericsson wins an NFV deal with Verizon. XDS Central is reporting that Verizon Enterprise Solutions have chosen orchestration and service assurance software from Ericsson to manage virtual network functions. Verizon wants to provide self-service options for customers to order and configure virtualized network services. And this seems like a nice little deal for Ericsson as they've struggled against folks like Huawei and ZTE.
Yeah, you've got to think that Ericsson must be fairly tightly embedded with Verizon, while AT&T is going the other way and trying to get control of their vendors. Verizon's willing to go down. Now, I'm not sure if this is just with a part of Verizon or whether this is Verizon's backbone. So is it a managed service provider play? Did you get a sense for that from the article?
Just that it's Verizon Enterprise Solutions.
Yeah, it's just the managed services arm.
Yeah, managed services.
Which is the business arm that previously did the exclusive deal with Viptela.
Mm-hmm, for SD-WAN.
For SD-WAN. So this might be a very small part of Verizon's overall network that's doing something a bit modern. So we probably don't want to get too caught up or assign too much importance to this. This is probably reasonably small in terms of Verizon Enterprise Group, who manage WANs for enterprises around the world. So I try not to overblow it, basically.
Yeah.
It's important. Good deal for Ericsson to get in there and displace. Maybe Enterprise Services has got a strong relationship with Ericsson. You might have thought they would have gone for Cisco for this to do with Cisco's ESTA NFV strategy, especially in the service provider space, but maybe Verizon's giving Cisco a bit of a nudge in the ribs.
Right, and I know also that Huawei has made serious investments in trying to build out orchestration and software platforms for just this kind of self-service provisioning. So Ericsson probably feels like, okay, we're fighting back here and a little win under our belt.
Yeah, well, Huawei's not going to get a run in the U.S. for various, for political reasons.
Of course, yeah.
But Ericsson's market in Europe is definitely under threat by Huawei and others as they search for just straight out cheaper pricing. You know, you can add all the value you like, but if the price is expensive, there's no value you can add to a lot of companies in Europe. They just need to cut the bottom line because of the market over here. The U.S. carrier market is extremely profitable and extremely rich. And so they can afford to make decisions that are not really based on price. Maybe they're the beneficiaries of that.
Could be. All right, story 6, Verizon gets a breach discount. It's official. Verizon is getting $350 million off its Yahoo acquisition price. This price drop is in response to a pair of hacks in which data was stolen from 1.5 billion user accounts. We should note, though, that Verizon, while they're getting a $350 million discount, they're still dropping $4.48 billion to pick up Yahoo.
Okay, so maybe I have to give you a mea culpa where we said doesn't look like Yahoo's gotten away clean with this, and Verizon does keep getting a discount, but even so, it's still pretty cheap security. Like, think about a company at Yahoo's size, how much they would have spent over 10 years if they actually had have done decent security. At $350 million discount, is that in addition to the previous one that they got? Did they get a $400 million one a while back for the first one?
I don't think so. I think this is the only discount.
So $35 million a year that have bad security. That's cheap.
Very cheap. It didn't kill the deal. As far as I know, no one at Yahoo was fired or disciplined, certainly not in the higher executive ranks. So all this talk about security being so important, when it comes to the money, it doesn't really seem to matter.
Yeah. For $35 million a year, that's just a decent security team. They got away with having even have one. So
right. Yeah.
You know, it would have cost them way more than that in terms of the share price drop. If they had announced the breach 5 years ago, as they should are now legally, so there are now new laws coming in where if a breach happens, they must disclose it immediately that they learn of it. You can't hide these things anymore. And, you know, this really should have been told. Customers and, you know, ordinary users, end users should have been warned and known that this was a problem. And Yahoo chose not to do it. And it's absolutely not acceptable that they did. But, you know, $350 million knocked off the sale price. That's small beer, really, considering.
Yeah, when you compare it against the full acquisition price, it's...
Yeah, and you think how much they got away with. Like, they didn't have to have security people. They might have only been in business because they didn't have good security. Because security prevents you from doing business. So if you have too much security, you might actually not be in business.
It can introduce friction, yeah. Yeah, it's distressing, but there it is. I should also note that Verizon will also have part of the deal. Verizon is going to participate in picking up some of the costs that come out of any legal action taken against Yahoo because of the breach. So I don't know who negotiated this deal on Yahoo's part, but they did a good job, it seems like.
I just think that if Verizon knows there's no negative impact here. They took the opportunity to get a discount, and Yahoo said, sure, we still want to get rid of these assets. So, yeah, whatever it takes to get it out the door. You know, and I'm sure there was some backwards and forwarding. But at the end of the day, I don't think there is any impact to the loss of user data. The users have already, the users who care have already long since Yahoo. We've known for a long time that your Yahoo accounts are a problem, but nobody could put a finger on why. And it's obviously because they were owned. So the customer attrition has already happened. The people that are still there aren't going to go anywhere because they're, you know, stupid, probably.
Or they forgot they had an account. I don't know. I mean, I still have an account there. I never use it, but it's just sitting there. So,
just always been problems with spam and stuff over there. I just never bothered. Yeah, and that's what I mean. If a lot of people who use Yahoo just know there's something wrong, they don't know why or what, so they just started getting away from it over time.
All right, story 7. Do we need an online Geneva Convention? This is coming from a blog by Microsoft President and Chief Legal Officer Brad Smith. He's calling for an international convention to, quote, commit governments to protecting civilians from nation-state attacks in times of peace. He cites the model of the 4th Geneva Convention, which lays out international rules for the treatment of civilians during wartime. Wow, that's kind of a head-scratcher.
I think there's a sort of a sense of we need to have a baseline for legal frameworks around the world so that if you think about Microsoft and they've got this problem in the US where the US government is forcing them to hand over data for Irish EU citizens under court law, and the data even resides in an Irish data center, and the judges are saying, and of course Microsoft doesn't want to do that. So a long-term strategy then is to start saying we need a global convention to underpin the legal frameworks for every company in the country in the world. Because you can imagine how difficult it's going to be for Microsoft as the years go by if the EU starts to take a different legislative and legal path than the one from the US. How do they reconcile a global internet against legal frameworks that are big enough to derail them? So that is if the entire EU, for example, starts to say our data protection laws look like this, or our hacking laws or our data security laws look like this, and over there in the US is like data security, who cares? They're all there to be exploited. We're going to make it going to be tremendous. We're going to make sure that there's no restrictions on exploiting everybody so that business can get out there and make money. Now, all of a sudden, you've got a foot in both camps. How does Microsoft reconcile the challenges between a US legal system that's completely different from the one in Europe?
Well, this blog is specifically focusing on nation state actors hacking into businesses and the technical infrastructure of private citizens. And they're saying we need to have a convention or some international agreements around, first, that we shouldn't do this, and second, some mechanisms that we can put in place to, I guess, punish people, nation states, if this does happen.
Yes, and that's the first step towards setting up this is the law that underpins the global arrangement, and local law can only be a derivative of this framework. That's my point.
I guess it just seems like a convoluted way to go about it, because trying to get nation states to sign on to anything that restricts their ability to act in the cybersphere seems like a really hard ball to move.
And that's why they're giving it a go. This is something that's a 10-year project, I imagine.
Absolutely. Anything like this would take a very long time, and it's going to actually take nation states to get on board with it to have any kind of meaning or teeth. And I can't imagine the United States. So he lays out a few goals that he would like to see. One of them is to create a public-private body that would share evidence to identify a nation state actor in an attack. I could see how the United States would love to have that, you know, in case of like China or Russia or some other adversary breaking into our systems. But if they were going to get pulled before a body like that to identify the U.S. attacking other countries, they'd be like, no, we're not going to do that. Forget it.
That's exactly it. And this is what I mean about you've got to have a unified data security law across the world. You've got to be able to have some sort of baseline that everybody works off. So the Geneva Conventions per se set basic levels of humanity. But even though, you know, you will not, you know, the Geneva Conventions, especially around war and you know, human rights, are very, very basic protections. And each country can then build its own version of law on top of that foundation, right? So, for example, human rights are basically saying people need the right to be fed, to live in peace. But the definition of peace might be very different from, say, Cuba to what's in America, as long as both companies don't actively go around and murder everybody. The Geneva Convention idea is that we need to agree that data security is a thing. We need to agree that basically these are the basic, simplest, most reductive, the bare minimum that we can do to define data security and start to form up some and that'll then start a cycle of creating international law, and then that will start to lead to a simplification of data security worldwide eventually.
Maybe. I think we're going to end up more with like a, whether it's explicit or not, a framework around mutually assured destruction, like we have with nuclear policy, where America and China sort of tacitly agree we're not going to take out each other's infrastructure grids because that would be bad for both of us. And we both know both of us are capable of doing it. So we have that in our back pocket if we really need it, but we both just aren't going to do it because it would be bad, a bad outcome.
I agree. Like, I'm not going to disagree with you, but what I am going to say is, what are the choices? Where do you start to get together to homogenize and come up with consistent data security laws? And right now we've got massive problems where one country is saying, going for like, there is no data security, there's no personal privacy, and we've got Europe going completely the other direction, which is to say people have an expectation of privacy and can demand it and companies must respond.
That's right. And they've even compelled companies to say that the internet should be able to forget about you, which is fantastic.
Yes. So how do you start to get a consistent global model for the law around this? And that's what this is. It's not going to I don't think it's going to happen. I'm with you. But I think that's their intention.
Well, we have a link to the blog. Take a look at it. It's a longer blog, but generates some interesting thoughts. All right, quick break to talk about ExtraHop, our other sponsor for today's show. ExtraHop is a leader in real-time IT analytics and pioneer of wired data, the window into digital transactions. They provide insight across the IT environment from the data center to the edge to the cloud to help IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. And for a long time, IT has thought about the network as either plumbing or the problem. With ExtraHop, the network becomes the biggest source you can get of real-time visibility for IT. ExtraHop does the analysis first and stores packets last, which creates wired data. And that encompasses all the interactions between IT systems and the organizations that rely on them. Wired data is rich, it's real-time, it's observed and objective. Analyzing it at scale transforms the network from just a transport function to the foundation of your digital experience. ExtraHop has companies like T-Mobile, Google, Adobe, McKesson, Netflix, helping them save millions of dollars and thousands of hours, improving application response times by more than 70%, and mean time to resolution by 90%. You can learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself if you visit them at extrahop.com/demo. And if you connect with them on Twitter, @ExtraHop, mention Packet Pushers, and you'll get a free t-shirt. ExtraHop, it's instant insight for IT.
And you should note, Drew, and I know because it's just published today, we did a podcast with them, a sponsored podcast, so full disclosure, where we went into one of the founders of the company and talked about how the product works and why it works. So if you actually want to get a discombobulated sort of under the hood look at how the product works and why you might be interested in it, show 328, Wired Data Analysis with ExtraHop, and there's a link in the show notes. Get a listen to it.
Yeah, their co-founder, Jesse Rothstein, he's a dyed-in-the-wool nerd, so you and Ethan went pretty deep with him. It was a good show.
Yeah, we actually came off really well, and I think they were when they heard back the play, they were pretty pleased. Came out as well as it did, and I'm pretty pleased to recommend it to you as well.
All right, go take a listen. Back to the news, story 8. You can get hybrid cloud on VxRail. Dell EMC is announcing that its enterprise hybrid cloud is now available on VxRail hyperconverged infrastructure appliances. Enterprise hybrid cloud lets companies provide a self-service portal for end users and lines of business so they can get IT services and applications, and it's designed to support from 200 to 1,000 virtual machines. However, you're going to pay a lot for this. The list price, according to Astoria Network World, is $1.25 million.
Who thought V blocks were dead?
Yeah.
Look at that.
There you go.
Repackaged and marked up, even more expensive than it was before. But the website talks about getting, you know, 3 times more likely to approach your digital transformation goals, 67% cost savings over 3 years, and 30% better business results. I'm not sure how you get a 30% better business result, but anyway. The appliance, of course, is a storage from EMC, which I think is a shame. Really, if you want to build a private cloud, vCenter is where you want to be. So why they put storage from EMC in there has got me beat. That shifts the price performance into a different area. And that's where I think most of the money will be coming from EMC, which makes me think vBlock. Also, vSphere and NSX, no problems with those. And then they've got a services package, and it must be using the software data center functionality of the VMware thing. So VxRail, of course, was VMware's push before the acquisition by Dell to try and get people to start thinking about turnkey solutions around the private cloud, so you get the ES as a service type thing. I'm not 100% sure that this is where we want it to be. Like the original version of VxRail, as I said, had vSAN in it, which made the storage a lot more flexible and a lot more speedy. And I agree that you might want to upgrade your VxRail to put EMC storage into the future, but I don't think you necessarily want to have it on day one. I think it's more important to start the transition to the private cloud at a modest price than to be stuck for like a $1 million deal to get started. That seems like you've got to bite down hard and go all in to make this work. And the second thing is that these numbers that they're talking about are not actually all that substantial. A private cloud transformation should be 100 times more likely to be transformative. Cost savings should be in the order of 500 to 1,000%. And, you know, the business outcomes really should be more like 300%. And I think the reason that these numbers are so modest and, in fact, quite honestly, so small is because the price of the product is so high. It's really not necessary to spend millions to build a private cloud. You could certainly start much more modestly and start the transformation project as a ramp, right? Rather, you don't have to eat the whole salami in one sitting. Try not to take a slice here and there, do you know?
I do, yes. And there are certainly other hyperconverged infrastructure offerings out there that I don't know that they're coming in at 1.25 million just to get it in the door.
No, it just seems like, but then again, you know, the enterprise IT just loves buying expensive stuff. If it's not a Rolls Royce, I don't want it, you know?
Right.
You know, and it doesn't actually have to work just so long as we paid a high price for it, because then that absolves us of responsibility sort of thing. I do think that there is definitely something in here. I think that the whole private cloud, if you're going to have a cloud solution on-prem, it's not about the hardware. It's not about definitely not about the storage. The storage is a trivial outcome. It's about the orchestration system that goes on the top. And the whole point here is that as soon as you say the emphasis of the product is all about its service and its backup and its storage capabilities, so this tells me that this is an EMC-led capability. They're focusing very much on the money. And the reason, and obviously they're going to pitch this to CIOs. This is not a technology sell. They're going to go into the CIOs and the CEOs and say, you have to do digital transformation. So I don't think that engineers are going to see this. This isn't going to be something where they go to their existing storage clients. They're going to be sending in the shiny suits and the expensive leather shoes and bums on airplanes to get in front of the CEO and say, it's time for you to spend millions on your IT because your existing IT is totally broken.
The existing IT that we sold to you 5 years ago is totally broken.
Now, but now we've got a better thing that's not broken because everything we've sold you for the last 20 years is actually broken.
Right, 'cause all that stuff that we had separately, we've put into one box for you now. Congratulations.
That's right. So we've put all the broken stuff together in one easy-to-buy broken package.
If you look at the marketing videos, I did look at some of them on the website for this product. It is very high level. I agree. It seems pitched at the executive level to say who are hearing these things about transformation and the need for speed and unruly developers rumbling around in the basement wanting to get their apps up faster. And so they're definitely pitching it that direction. Part of that 1.25 million package also means it comes with a service package. So folks will actually come to your door and help you get it up and running, which also should tell you something about how easy it is to use.
Mm. And the hybrid part is actually its integration with VirtuStream, the EMC cloud.
Okay, that's what I was wondering, because they call it hybrid cloud, but it sounds to me like private cloud.
It's certainly private cloud, but there's some links to the VirtuStream public cloud. So the off-prem part isn't Azure, AWS, you know, the
your standard
love child of everybody in the industry. It seems very difficult to go through a show without talking about AWS somewhere. They're actually talking as hybrid cloud, as your private cloud and EMC's public, semi-public cloud, VirtuStream.
Okay.
That is apparently up for sale.
Oh, really?
So Yeah, the rumor was that when Dell bought it, they were trying to sell VirtuStream off and looking for a buyer. And now all of a sudden they've got a product tied into it, and it's not vCloud Air, which is a bit weird.
That's also weird.
I'm a little cautious here. I'm sure that VirtuStream is a fine public cloud, but it's certainly not necessarily going to be around for all that long.
Mm.
I thought that Dell was trying to sell it, unless something's changed. So if you are getting into a deal, make sure you ask what's happening to VirtuStream. Is it actually up for sale or is it not? And get some guarantees written into your contract.
Good advice. All right, our last story for today's show, HPE's quarterly results. They can be summed up in one word: down. They posted revenues of $11.4 billion for their first fiscal quarter of 2017, which is a 10% drop from this quarter last year. Of the four business units they called out, only one, the financial services unit, showed any year-over-year growth. The enterprise group, the enterprise services group, and the software units, they all shrank.
Yeah, so this is a consistent story. We saw Cisco's results were last week, and they were down 5 to 10% across the board. HP's quarterly results are down more like 10% across the board. Now, I will be a little cautious here. They did say that a lot of this is because of divestitures. So remember, they sold the HP software business.
They went through a fire sale in the end of last year, yeah.
That's right. And a whole lot of business units have been gone. So some of the declines associated with the divestitures, and in their financial results, they say, but if we adjusted it for our divestitures, it would be much better than this. So for example, networking revenue was down 33%. That seems like a huge drop considering that Aruba has actually not been failing, but that if you adjust it for what was divested, they must have gotten rid of some networking. They sold the H3C through to the companies in China. So if you actually did the adjustment, networking was up 6%. But the numbers as they are saying networking revenue is down, but that's because a lot of the H3C assets were transferred off to the company in China that they sold them to.
Okay, so this seems like a pretty tough earnings report, but if you're talking about what they call the non-generally accepted accounting practices, they've got an explanation here that so people shouldn't panic.
Yes. So the basic story here is that HPE has been divesting itself of things. So as it gets rid of business lines, revenue has to shrink. So if you adjusted for those and said, yet if I hadn't have sold those, I would have had this much revenue, then I would have been not quite so bad. It would have been down sort of 4 to 5%, but shrank about as much as Cisco did in the end and so forth.
And we have talked about some recent HPE acquisitions, so they know they're not just sitting back. They're actively trying to move forward and redirect the business. So we'll have to see what Q2 2017 looks like if now that they've got this sort of bad news off the books.
That's right. So at the end of the day, like Cisco, HPE has actually hit its profits and started to increase its dividend. And so shareholders like that. And so everybody's happy.
Yeah, the bright spot that came out is that the earnings per share was actually up 7% over last year. So some good news for HPE as well.
Yes, people are betting on the fact that HPE has a growth strategy. So because they're not collapsing and falling down in a pile like lots of people think, then you're starting to look at a positive outlook for them. The investors believe that HPE can turn the ship around and embrace the public cloud, private cloud, or has answers to continue growing revenue over time.
That's right. So we'll definitely be back to check on that in quarter two and see how they're doing.
For sure, as always.
As always. All right, but that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
People can find me on my blog at Ethereal Mind, but most of my writing is at packetpushers.net. And don't forget that we have a YouTube channel, so Packet Pushers Network. You can go and search it up on YouTube. Ethan and I have been producing some videos and wandering our sad little way to putting our faces into moving pictures of all things. We're trying to work out how this works. So by all means, come along and watch it. We'd love to hear your feedback. Give us some comments about whether what we're doing is right or wrong. Wrong would be great. If you think of there's some ways for us to do better, that would be good. And of course, I'm on Twitter and a range of other social media things.
All right. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM and I blog at packetpushers.net. And do take a look at YouTube and give us some feedback. Let us know what works and what doesn't, because we're just trying to figure this out and find the best way to get some information across via video. So let us know what you think. Thank you to our sponsors, INE and ExtraHop, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook. A recommendation on iTunes is always appreciated, and you can share it with your friends. Please check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to sign up for those for free at packetpushers.net. And don't forget all the other fine, free technical content you'll find at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.